Welcome to the Falling Out edition of It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, are you talking about us?
No, Ken. We're not falling out, at least not any farther than we've ever been. It's all those other people who are falling out.
Well, there's Sarah Palin and Fox News. We know
and
about
I always
that.
Thought they were perfect together. I can't believe they're splitting up.
They did have a good relationship when people cared about Sarah Palin. And, of course, we have the breakup of CNN and Mary Madeline and James Carville, that threesome.
We should make it clear that Mary and James are still together, but they are no longer together with CNN, which has decided it wants all of its on-air contributors to be there on set. And, of course, they've got a really busy travel schedule, and so they're not going to be there anymore.
And, of course, the love affair that used to exist between Chuck Hagel and John McCain.
Ooh, not such a good one.
No. They had a
pretty heated exchange. Just listen to a little bit of what went on there this week.
This is from Thursday's Senate Armed Services Committee hearing.
Will you please answer the question, were you correct or incorrect when you said that the surge would be the most dangerous foreign policy blunder in this country since Vietnam? Were you correct or incorrect? Yes or no?
My reference to the surge being the most dangerous.
Are you going to answer the question, Senator Hagel? The question is, were you right or wrong? That's a pretty straightforward question.
I would
like to answer whether you're right or wrong, and then you are free to elaborate.
Well, I'm not going to give you a yes or no answer
well,
on a lot of things.
Well, let the record show that
today.
You refuse to answer that question. Now, please go ahead.
Ron, does this remind you of some movie scene?
It does indeed.
Colonel Jessup, did you order the code red?
You don't have to answer that question.
I'll answer the question. You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
That, of course, was not from this week's hearing. That is from the somewhat classic film, A Few Good Men, and that was Tom Cruise and, of course, Jack Nicholson.
Right, one of my favorite golfers.
All right.
And the thing is, of course, is that Chuck Hagel and John McCain used to be great friends. Of course, Chuck Hagel was one of John McCain's biggest boosters when he first ran for president in 2000.
In 2000.
That was the old John McCain. There have been several incarnations since. And also, they have the commonality of serving in Vietnam.
That's right. Also, they both were very good friends with Lindsey Graham, and there were several other senators who were involved in sort of a group of guys who haven't had a certain amount of affinity in that era, in particularly the early 2000s. And then along came the Iraq War, which initially Chuck Hagel supported.
Right.
But as the war went on and as the country grew disaffected from that particular conflict, so did Chuck Hagel. And he became a critic of it and even a critic of the surge by right. which the war became more successful toward its conclusion. And, you know, George W. Bush, to some degree, was able to recover what had been a disastrous military situation.
But that's the key, though, because as he became a bigger critic of the war, he also became a bigger critic of President Bush's handling of the war. And that really was probably what set John McCain off, because McCain was not so much a steadfast follower and supporter of the Rumsfeld way of doing the war, because McCain was very critical of Rumsfeld, but he didn't like the fact that by criticizing Bush and the surge, this is really a criticism of the Republican Party, and McCain really never got over that, especially the fact that in 2008, when John McCain was the Republican nominee for president, Chuck Hagel said some very nice things about Barack Obama, and McCain resented that.
That's right. Well, he expected his longtime friend in the Senate, not to mention also colleague in the Republican Party, to be more supportive of him
right.
as the Republican nominee. And, of course, in 2012, Chuck Hagel was out there for Barack Obama again. He was even endorsing a Democratic candidate for his old Senate seat or for a
right.
Senate
Bob
seat
Kerry,
in Nebraska.
Another Vietnam veteran.
And he endorsed him. So he has been, if you will, by the lights of the Republican Party, disloyal on a number of occasions in a number of these contests, not to mention the fact that he didn't stand four square with President Bush in the later years of the Iraq War.
And that's why I always thought, and we've said this in previous podcasts, the difficulty for Chuck Hagel for his confirmation was never about Israel and Hezbollah, the Chuck Schumers of the world, because first of all, one Schumer is on board, and I think every Democrat is on board. It's always been the Republican Party, because Chuck Hagel had his maverick ways when it came to the Republican Party. Not everybody appreciated that kind of independence.
Even though John McCain was at one time considered
the maverick,
a maverick himself,
right.
as we've been famously reminded many times. But we should also say that there were some positions, there were statements made by Chuck Hagel, who has not always been that careful about the way he phrased things, that were offensive to people, that he sounded as though he were more accommodating towards Iran. And in his opening statement in the hearing this week, he tried to dispel any suspicion that he did not support the president's position on Iran and denying them any kind of an access to a nuclear weapon. And also making use of the phrase Jewish lobby, which we've talked about before.
And in Thursday's opening statement, Chuck Hagel really stayed clear of all those kind of controversies. And we should also remember that this is still going to be President Obama's foreign policy. Just as, you know, John Kerry will serve President Obama, so will Chuck Hagel. So it's not that Chuck Hagel is going to go off on his own and have this whole foreign policy as Secretary of Defense.
So what is the struggle here, really? What are the Republicans hoping to accomplish by opposing one of their own, somebody who at least used to be one of their own, in his nomination to be Secretary of Defense? What are they hoping to accomplish? Are they really trying to stop him from getting the job, or is there something else in the agenda?
Well, look, you know, you always talk about the possibility that a lot of people say that Republicans are out to just, you know, thwart President Obama and everything he does, and that's why they oppose Susan Rice, that's why they oppose Chuck Hagel. But I think a lot of it with Chuck Hagel is personal. More about Chuck Hagel, less about Barack Obama. And unless they decide to filibuster the nomination, which it doesn't look like they will, I think they'll be happy with their 30, 35 votes against the nomination, and that'll be it.
The first Republican to come out for Chuck Hagel was Thad Cochran, who is a senior senator who has been on the Senate Appropriations Committee, where he was ranking member for 6 years, and also where he headed up the defense subcommittee on that panel. So he has some defense credibility, some bona fides in this area, and he came out for Chuck Hagel. I think there will be others.
Oh, sure.
In the end, I don't believe the Republicans will oppose him.
No, Susan Collins even said some nice things about him this week. So, look, I think they just want to make their point, which was an amazing contrast to the 94-3 vote that John Kerry got as Secretary of State. Only three Republicans voted no about that, and which is pretty remarkable given the fact that John Kerry, took him 25 years to become the senior senator from Massachusetts.
Well, because of Teddy Kennedy.
Right, yes, and it took Elizabeth Warren 3 weeks.
Yes. Well, how long did Fritz Hollings wait to be senior senator from South Carolina?
Right, he was junior senator for 36 years, which was a record. He didn't become the senior senator until Strom Thurmond retired in 2002 at the age of 419.
Give or take a decade.
Right.
All right. Other things going on in the Senate this week, and there's really been a lot. The Senate has really been the locus of attention. We had eight senators come out saying that they had already, as a bipartisan group—
Four Democrats, four Republicans.
That would be bipartisan. They actually had worked out a proposal on immigration that includes a path to citizenship for people already in the country illegally. That was on Monday. And on Tuesday, the president went to Las Vegas, Nevada, and gave a speech about immigration in which he talked about the 11 million already in the country illegally.
Yes, they broke the rules. They crossed the border illegally. Maybe they overstayed their visas. Those are the facts. Nobody disputes them. But these 11 million men and women are now here. Many of them have been here for years. And the overwhelming majority of these individuals aren't looking for any trouble. They're contributing members of the community. They're looking out for their families. They're looking out for their neighbors. They're woven into the fabric of our lives.
And here lies the conflict, because this bipartisan group of senators talked about a path to citizenship only after the border was secure.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, look, you know, we're really getting things done. It's Chuck Schumer and Bob Menendez and Dick Durbin and Marco Rubio. And so they're saying, we'll get this done. But the president is saying, wait a second, when is the border going to be secure? Who's going to determine that? And do we have to wait until this unknown time for these 11 million people here illegally to get to the path of citizenship?
I suspect the president would contend the border is secure now. The number of people being detained at the border, the people trying to enter the country illegally, is down. The number of people having been deported from the country last year was a record high by this administration, by any administration. I think the president is going to contend that we have border security. We have as much as we're ever likely to have, and that putting any sort of an artificial bar that has to be crossed to get this law going is just an excuse for not doing the law at all.
And the Republicans will argue that by interfering the way he is, in their words, President Obama is sabotaging this bipartisan effort. But there's also no unanimity on the Republican side about what to be done. We saw Lamar Smith, the former chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, saying, look, this is amnesty. This is not going to work. And you know what I thought was the most interesting thing in the whole thing is the role played by Marco Rubio. Yes, he's Hispanic. Yes, he's a potential presidential candidate. But he is taking risks by standing up for this position. And he's taking a lot of heat from those in the Republican Party who just feel this is all about amnesty.
Well, Marco Rubio also was catapulted into statewide office, not just as a Cuban American, but also as a Tea Party leader, somebody who was a hero of the 2010 movement against President Obama and in favor of a different definition of government entirely, a more constitutional government. And these people, by and large, have been highly opposed to anything that smacked of amnesty. And amnesty is the word that has killed the last two or three attempts at immigration overhaul or revamping or changing of our laws. So it seems to me Marco Rubio has, to some degree, thrown his hat on one side or the other. He has said, I am going to be, in this case, pro-immigration change, pro-opportunity, pro-path to citizenship, whatever you want to call it, and he is going to be accused of amnesty, and he has made a choice between his Tea Party background and his larger aims and goals as a Cuban-American, son of immigrants, somebody who wants to effectuate a new America.
I just wondered, though, that, you know, we talked about this bipartisan group in the Senate coming together, that there's a potential for some kind of headway for immigration reform or overhaul, which we have not seen in decades. And yet,
1986
right,
was the last time it really happened.
And now, if the only result is bickering and distrust and mistrust between the Republicans and the President Obama, among Republicans themselves, you wonder if anything will happen about this, and which makes me think of the other big issue in Washington this week, which was guns. After the horrific shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary School, we thought, well, maybe something might change. And for all the emotions that came out of the horror, one still wonders what the end result will be.
Well, let's start with the high point emotionally of those Senate hearings on Wednesday of this week, when former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords gave these remarks.
It will be hard, but the time is now. You must act. Be bold, be courageous. Americans are counting on you.
This was very, very emotional. I mean, of course, her own personal tragedy when she was shot at a Tucson shopping center in 2011. And you could see just by watching her, hearing her, you see how the effects of that shooting probably will never go away. And then at the same time, we have Joe Donnelly, the newly elected Democratic senator from Indiana, says, I'm not going to support an assault weapon ban. Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota. Another Democrat who the Democrats were so excited about with victories in 2012 said, oh, no, there's no way I'm going to support that. So I think ultimately Harry Reid will allow a vote on banning assault weapons to reach the Senate. I think it does fail because many pro-gun Democrats can't stomach that. But maybe that gives the Senate the opportunity to do something about guns, and perhaps it may only be limiting the size of the magazines.
I don't know exactly what they're going to do. I do feel as though they will feel compelled to do something, and it may center on background checks. It may center on what's called the gun show loophole or the transfer of guns among family members. There's going to be something. Someone will be the scapegoat for this energy because it's just too great. In all the years since they initially passed an assault weapons ban, or what was called an assault weapons ban, there were 30-some guns that were banned.
In 94.
30-some kinds. In 1994, which was also in response to a schoolyard shooting, this one in California in 1989, it took that long for it to get to federal legislation, and then they sunsetted it. That meant that if they didn't renew it in 10 years, it didn't continue. So 10 years later, they had the votes, but they didn't get the overall bill that it was attached to, passed. Therefore, it died. It expired. And I can't emphasize this too much. The Democrats blamed that 1994 gun element in the crime bill of that year for their loss of the House and Senate in 1994. It wasn't the only factor, certainly, but they put a lot of weight on it and continue to do so. But guns became a kind of third rail, like Social Security and a few other issues in American politics, and the Democrats have really shied away from it ever since. So after Newtown, you do have the president energized. You have Joe Biden out there with his task force. You have a lot of senators who want to do something. They will find a scapegoat. They will find some issue to go after. But I cannot imagine them reviving the gun ban. And frankly, it's hard to imagine them really coming up with a meaningful and effective way to limit magazines or ammunition.
And of course, you know, on the same day of the hearings, it was a front page article of the New York Times that talked about Chicago, a city that has stronger gun control than perhaps any place else in the country.
Well, laws at any
laws,
rate.
Laws, right. Yes. That's fair. But also an unbelievable amount of gun deaths in 2012, and already in 2013, there have been like 45 people killed in Chicago via firearms, including one of the young girls who performed.
Had been here for the inauguration.
For the inauguration. So, I mean, Obama will say, well, look, these guns are coming from outside of Chicago. Anybody, since there's no universal standard, guns could be shipped in. But as Wayne LaPierre, the CEO of the National Rifle Association, has argued, that you could have all the gun laws in the world, but if they're not properly and fully enforced, they're going to be ineffective.
That's right. And I suspect that we'll have a lot of back and forth about whether or not the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms is adequately funded and whether or not there have been resources to enforce the laws. And these are arguments we've been having for decades and generations, and I suspect they will continue into the future. I expect some kind of legislation to come out of the Senate, and then we'll discuss where it goes in the House, where, frankly, the prospects are even poorer than they are in the Senate. There is a Republican majority, and the Republican Party has shown very little interest in any kind of restraint of Second Amendment rights.
Speaking about coming out of the Senate, John Kerry, of course, officially left the Senate this week, being confirmed as Secretary of State. And we have a new senator from Massachusetts.
Yes, we do. Mo Cowan, who is a lawyer in Boston, 43 years old, Boston attorney, African-American, former aide to Governor Deval Patrick. And Governor Patrick had said that he was very interested in appointing either a woman or a minority or both to this particular opening for John Kerry's seat, which is just an interim appointment because they'll have an election in June.
Right, June 25th special election. For history folks and trivia folks, this new appointment makes it the first time in history that two African-American senators have served together at the same time. Of course, Tim Scott, being in South Carolina, also an appointee. That's kind of interesting. And it was also a public rebuff of Barney Frank, the former congressman, longtime congressman, who openly lobbied for this job. He spoke to Deval Patrick, said he really wants it, and Deval Patrick, similarly to Neil Abercrombie in Hawaii, who picked his own lieutenant governor, Deval Patrick picked his former chief of staff.
Now, we should point out that Tim Scott is going to be there in the Senate until at least 2014, right, when he has to be on the ballot, and thereafter is a strong favorite to probably hold that seat and be a senator for a long time, whereas Mo Cowan has said he is not a candidate in the special election, primary on April 30th and the special on June 25th. He will not be running, but there are some other Democrats in the state who are interested in the real seat, the elected seat, starting with Ed Markey, and now a second congressman
for
the state.
Well, that's what it looks like. I mean, we are doing this podcast on Thursday, but the indication seemed to show that Stephen Lynch, another Democratic congressman
from the Boston area,
will get in the race. Now, most polls show Ed Markey with a huge, huge lead over Stephen Lynch. Lynch is very popular with unions, but he's also pro-life, which is kind of not perhaps the majority opinion among Democrats in Massachusetts. But so they may be very well be a Democratic primary. We're still waiting for Scott Brown to make a decision, the former Republican senator, who may very well run once again. But it's also interesting, Deval Patrick has now appointed two temporary senators. Remember Paul Kirk?
Yes.
After Ted Kennedy passed away.
Another woman, another minority.
But Paul Kirk also was an interim senator, and then that led to the Scott Brown election.
So the pattern that they've taken there is not trying to give somebody a leg up or a boost towards actually holding the seat, as is typical in some other states. And by the way, you know, Scott Brown may not have said yet whether or not he wants to run, but the polls are pretty attractive. The polls are luring him in, telling him he would beat either Markey or Lynch at this point.
Right. Now, of course, John Kerry has left the Senate, and now we have the announcement last week that two other longtime members of the Senate are also leaving, first one being Tom Harkin in Iowa.
Truly long time. Goes back to 1984.
Right.
When he defeated Roger Jepson.
Right.
In a year when Ronald Reagan was sweeping 49 states nationally, including Iowa, and really in which the mood in Iowa was very pro-Reagan, and it was amazing that Tom Harkin, a real liberal, I mean a good old-fashioned 1930s great society labor liberal from the southwestern part of the state, was able to defeat an incumbent Republican senator in that environment, and he's been reelected ever since.
Well, and it's fascinating because all these years, Iowa continually reelects a liberal Tom Harkin and a conservative Chuck Grassley to the Senate. And in Iowa, the Democrats seem to be settling on Bruce Braley. He was once looking at a gubernatorial race, but now with Harkin leaving, he may run for the Senate. But there could be a Republican primary between Tom Latham, considered the establishment choice, perhaps a winner in November, and Steve King, a very strong Tea Party, anti-illegal immigration firebrand that could well win a primary, but perhaps could lose a general election.
That's right. Biggest supporter of Michelle Bachmann, as I recall, in the presidential sweepstakes there in Iowa. All right. Ken, I think you're going to be interested in this next retirement.
I think what happened to Chambliss was unbelievable. And it's the one that really brings back strong memories for me.
He hits one deep to right center. That ball is out of here. The Yankees win the pennant. Holy cow, Chris Chambliss on one swing.
That's Chris Chambliss?
Right, right.
That was Chris Chambliss back in the 1970s?
1976, right? Yankee Stadium, right?
Yeah, this is Saxby Chambliss. Saxby Chambliss from Georgia, the two-term senator from Georgia.
Oh, that's what we're talking about.
Saxby Chambliss.
He announced this week he will retire, not seek a third term. He had been under a lot of pressure from conservatives in his party because, one, he kind of broke with Grover Norquist on the no-tax pledge. And, two, he said, look, I'm more interested in helping the country than honoring a pledge I made some 20 years ago. At the same time, he's also been working with Democrats like Mark Warner of Virginia to help lower the deficit. And there are a lot of Republicans who, you know, again, hate the fact that he's working with Democrats.
It certainly made him vulnerable in any kind of a primary. And Tea Party people had been saying that they were planning to find a candidate.
Paul Brown, the congressman, Tom Price, another congressman, perhaps Karen Handel, the former Secretary of State. They were all talking about running. Now, of course, with Chambliss leaving, it opens the door for a big wide open Republican primary.
And one other senator in the news this week, and not for a story that he was eager to see come back. We had heard back in the fall that Robert Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, had taken some flights on some planes that were paid for by a big donor who has some ties to New Jersey, lives in South Florida most of the time, and that these flights sometimes went overseas to the Dominican Republic. This week, that story was back, and he announced that he had paid $58,000 in repayment to that particular donor. Seems a little late, as the check just came this week. And also, there was an allegation about what he was going to the Dominican Republic for.
Well, what we do know is that the FBI raided the office of this doctor in Florida, and we don't know what kind of documents they came away with, and there have been kind of wild speculation in the blogosphere, but Menendez's office released a statement basically saying that, and all this stuff about prostitution, well, that's completely scandalous and not true. Now, nobody...
Well, not nobody.
Well, certainly, aside from the blogs.
That's right. The blogs and Daily Caller and websites such as that had brought up this issue of whether or not he was going to the Dominican Republic to avail himself of such services. But it was his office that was quite explicit about saying that's simply not true.
And that's so remarkable because Menendez had a very high-profile week in the Senate because, of course, with John Kerry leaving the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that now the head of it now becomes the same Robert Menendez.
Yes, he's already conducted a couple of hearings in the chairmanship. And that's a very high-profile chair. That's up there with maybe two or three others as the most prestigious in the Senate. Not to mention the fact, of course, that he had already been chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee.
In fairness to Menendez, nothing has been proven. There have been no official allegations, but there have been talks about corruption since Menendez first came to the Senate via appointment when John Corzine left to become governor. And as far as any kind of electoral problems for Menendez, he's not up for re-election for a bunch of years, so we'll see what happens.
We will indeed, and that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. The podcast is produced by Bracton Booker and edited by Kathy Shaw.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Breaking up is hard to do. Don't take your love away from me. Don't you leave my heart in misery. If you go, then I'll be blue, 'cause breaking up is hard to do.